Last week, we were in the middle of discussing the connection between the guf, the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama. We need to know that everything we know about a human being, that includes his physical makeup, it includes his obligation in this world, it includes reward and punishment, it includes his abilities, both physical and spiritual, it includes his thoughts, his nature, his behavior, it includes everything we know about him is all contained in this chapter about the guf and the neshama and its relationship. There is absolutely nothing about a human being, no story you're going to hear, no explanation that you're going to see, no interpretation that you're going to find that lies outside the realm of this topic that we're learning about now, the guf and the different chalakim of the neshama. Last week we had two things that we're going to go into a bit more this week. Number one, we discussed the fact that Bechira is a product of the neshama because it can't be a product of the guf. And number two, we discussed how the neshama is formed. It goes, B'toy chazera achra hi kol toy, the Ramchal said. And those things we're going to start this evening. First, we mentioned last week that it's not possible for Bechira, for a person's free will, to be a product of the person's guf, or of his emotions, or of his physical makeup. And we explained the reason. The reason is because it's a law of physics in the world that every effect has to have a cause. Every mesoiviv has to have a siba. There's absolutely nothing in the world that doesn't have a reason why it happened. We're not going to go into this at length. We did it last week. We're just going to review until the point where we continue. Everything has to have a reason. If you throw the dice and it ends and it falls on 7, there's a reason why it fell on 7 and not 8. And if you do the exact type of throw another time, the exact same type of throw, the dice will end up on 7 again. There's no such thing as something that happens without a reason. It's not possible for anything to happen at random in this world. Random is a misnomer. Nothing can happen at random in the world. It can happen unbeknownst to you. It can happen without your intent. It can happen by accident, meaning that you didn't want it to happen, but there's no such thing as random. If you take a computer and you ask the computer to generate random numbers, it's going to trick you because it will not generate random numbers. The way a computer can't generate random numbers, because the first thing it's going to ask is, okay, what number should I generate? How is it supposed to know what number to generate? The way a computer generates random numbers is through tricks. Usually what it does is, it figures out what time it is at any given moment, and it figures out not only the hours and the minutes or the seconds, but it figures out the hundredths of seconds, and it takes the number of the hundredths of seconds that it decides, at that point in time where it's creating the random number. Let's say it's 6:35 p.m. and 430 seconds and 99 hundredths of a second. It'll take 99 as a random number. So even though it looks random, but there's a din v'cheshbin as to how that computer got that number. In fact, try as you might, you could be Bill Gates to the 10th power, you are not going to be able to program a computer to generate random numbers because randomness in this world does not exist. That's the aside. Randomness in this world does not exist. There's always a reason why something happened. And so, as we started last week, how in the world could a person have free will? There has to be a reason why he made one choice over the other. And we said, therefore, free will is a miracle. It's a first cause. Now, that was step one. Now let's take it to step two, the next step. We learned last year, in chapter one in the Ramchal, that Ramchal, and it really comes from the Rambam, it comes from Rav Sajji Goyin, it comes from the Rishonim. We know there could only be one Hashem. It's not possible to have two Hashems. For various reasons. It makes absolutely no sense. One of the reasons we said is because you can't have two entities that are all-powerful, the Hakol Yochel. Because if you have two gods, question, can one god destroy the other god? If he can, then the second god is not impervious, invulnerable to the first one, so he's not all-powerful. If he can't, then this first God is not all-powerful because he can't destroy the second God. Another reason we had, that Ramchal mentioned, is because we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this is the most important thing we know about him, is that he is a causeless entity. Even though, as we just said, everything in this world has a cause, God has no cause. It's something we can't imagine, but on paper, it's proven. God has no cause. The thing is that you can only have one entity that's causeless. Because if you have two entities that have no cause, it makes no sense. Because there has to be a reason, meaning a cause, that one is not the other. If you have two things, that means they are bound, they have boundaries, where one ends and the other begins, or where one is and the other is not, or why one is and the other isn't there. And you cannot have two entities that are both causeless, both without definition. By definition, if you have something without definition, it means you can't have two of them, because two of them, you just quantified it. It means you have one over here and one over there. One doesn't encroach on the other, and that makes no sense. Now, if you can only have one first cause, and that's what we established last year, in chapter one, if you can only have one first cause, how in the world could our Bechira be a first cause? If Bechira exists, and surely it does, because it says so in the Torah countless times, Schar Va'oinish is one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Without Bechira, there's no Schar Va'oinish. It wouldn't even be called Schar Va'oinish. If we would have Schar Va'oinish without Bechira, it wouldn't even be called reward and punishment. It would be called different treatments for different person at the whim of Hashem. The concept of reward and punishment only works if you deserve it or you earn it. That means there has to, Bechira is one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim. If Bechira exists, the only way Bechira exists is if it's miraculously a first cause, and the problem is, you can't have more than one first cause. Now God himself, if he would want to, can he make another first cause? Can he allow you to choose something without a reason? That's a very interesting question. For those who weren't here last year, this is the issue. There are many things you're going to find in Svarim that use terminology that says God cannot do X, Y, Z. The Rambam, God cannot commit suicide. God cannot make another God. God cannot scratch his nose. Let's not be so philosophical. God cannot scratch his nose even if he wanted to. And the question is, does this create a limitation on God's power? And the answer is no. The whole question is just sophistry. And as we explained last year, it's the same thing like asking, can God make a Mixius Pitlick? There's no such thing. It's just gibberish. Can he make it? Well, the answer is there's no such thing. How could God make it? And the problem lies in the question, because you're not putting something on the table to ask if God can make it. You're just saying sounds. You're making sounds with your mouth that sounds to the uninitiated like you're asking a question, but you're really not asking a question. Can God make danger? That's not a sakana. Well, there's no such, it's a meaningless statement. There's no such thing as danger that's not a sakana, right? Can make God make danger that's not perilous. It's just a play with words. It's like asking a bird to chirp, and after the bird chirps, can God do that? Well, can God do what? There's no that you're asking God to do. And any time you're going to find statements in the Rishonim that God cannot do X, Y, Z, the reason is not because God doesn't have the power to do whatever it is, but because there is no whatever it is for God to do. When you say, can God commit suicide, you want to know, can an eternal being that's in effect, that's invulnerable to everything, that's not affected by anything, be affected by something? Can God be vulnerable and invulnerable at the same time? That's the same as asking, can something be dangerous and safe at the same time? Makes no sense. There is nothing. God committing suicide is a conceptual self-contradiction, no less than danger that's not perilous. Makes no sense. Can God make another God is the exact same thing. Can God, which is a causeless being that has no definitions, meaning no boundaries, that's undefined, define himself? Well, if he's undefined, then he can't define himself. He's just asking words. It's not a question of what God, it's not a question of how much ability God has. And so now when we say that God cannot create another first cause, well, obviously if God creates it, it's not a first cause. It's like saying, can God create something that isn't created by God? How's that one? So you don't have to ask if God can create a rock that's too heavy for him to lift, which is also an oxymoron. Let's be cuter. Can God create something that was created by itself and not by God? Well, it's the same sophistry. The whole question makes no sense. And can God create another first cause? Well, if he created, it's not a first cause. So here's a question. Can God give somebody the ability to make choices without a cause? It says, in all the Rishonim, that everything in the world that happens, all is traced back to the first cause. So if that's a fact that's inescapable, then how in the world can a human being have Bechira? Bechira, the only way Bechira can exist is if Bechira is a first cause. Because if Bechira is caused by something, meaning your choice, if your choice is caused by something, then it's not Bechira. So we're stuck. Now before we come to the answer to this, let's see what else happens. What other Torah concepts we can understand based on this principle that everything's traced back to the first cause. We know everything is Gamzu L'Toiva, right? You know why everything's Gamzu L'Toiva? Because anything that happened has a cause, right? Had to. And that cause had a cause which in turn had its cause. And it all gets traced back to what? The first cause, meaning God. So ultimately, whatever happens to you, whatever happens in the world, only happens because God, for no reason, no prior cause, decided that it should happen. Everything that happens is God directly making it happen through a domino effect of causes, but God directly making it happen. Nothing in this world can happen logically. Never mind Yiddishkeit. There's no logic to say that anything in this world can happen except by the word of Hashem. It's a domino effect from the first cause, and to us it seems like a long time. Could be there are trillions of causes in that chain of cause and effect that traces back to Hashem, but ultimately a trillion or three, it makes no difference. It all gets traced back to Hashem, the first cause. And if something happens to you, it doesn't matter if there are trillion causes between you and Hashem, it happened directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is no way out of this. And now, if there can only be one first cause, and our Bechira is a first cause, what does that mean? That means that we now understand on some level what it means that a human being's neshama, dahainu, a.k.a. a human being's bechira, is a tzelem Elohim. This power is power that only God could have. But we were granted a bit of that power. This is a power to create effects without any cause. Without understanding anything else of it, just on this level, we have been granted by God power that only God logically could possess. If you're going to say that we don't have it, then you could throw away the Ikar of Schar Va'onish, you could throw away Bechira, you can throw away everything. If you agree to Bechira, then you have to agree that the Bechira is a first cause, and you have to agree that the Bechira is caused by a power that only God theoretically can possess. Hashgacha is also all rolled up into this principle. Because as we said, everything in the world that happens is traced back through a finite number of causes and effects to the ultimate first cause. Everything in the world if you're able to calculate it properly, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was, is perfectly able to calculate the future. The future is predetermined already, because if every effect has a cause, and different causes bring about different effects, then if you're aware of the first cause or the second cause, and you're also aware of what cause would result in what effects, then you will be aware of all the effects throughout history, throughout the future. The only question is Bechira. If Bechira is a first cause, and it is, and God gave us the ability to have the first cause, then the ability for Hashem to know what our Bechira decisions will be comes from some other place, rather than knowing the first cause and all its domino effects. And when we get later on to Hashgacha, we're going to discuss that. But in the meantime, we're beginning to understand a bit of what it means, Tzelem Elokim. We have to understand that Bechira is physically impossible. Not only physically impossible, it's more than impossible. It's more than against the laws of nature. It's a nonsensical concept unless you are endowed with some power that only HaKadosh Baruch Hu could conceivably possess. And now we're going to continue our discussion on how the neshama is created. And I'm reading you, we translate it into Hebrew, reading from parts of the Zohar in Vayikra. Shloisha madregois hein, well, Sisra de Sisran l'chakim alibo, a secret of secrets for wise people. Shloisha madregois hein, hanechozai zubazu. And this is the source for the Ramchal that we read last week. There are three levels of a neshama, each one connected to the next. Eluhein, nefesh ruach neshama. Nefesh hi bechinas haguf. Nefesh, the nefesh, is conceptually the same as the guf. Koyach shehaguf nivne mimenu. Remember the Ramchal said that through the nefesh, the guf is created? The Zohar says the nefesh is the power that creates the body. Ki kishadam isayir boilam hazel is davik benukva. Kol ha'ivorim muskomim, umisaknim lehenois mizeh. When a person on this world joins with the Nekeva, so all his Eivorim are Nehene, and they all agree to this act that he's about to perform. The Nefesh of a person, meaning the life force, and the Rotzain of a person, suddenly joins with his body together to do this act, and thereby it kind of extracts the nefesh from the person, and it puts it into the zera that comes out, and that's the koyach of the nefesh. What happens is that the human being, his entire rotzoin and his entire body kind of extracts that life force from him. And it's able to create another person through his own life force. The same way, kind of like an apple produces a seed that's able to produce another apple, the mechanism by which the nefesh, I'm not talking physical cells, we're talking the mechanism by which the nefesh is extracted and is planted into a new body, is that emotional and psychological a connection that the Zohar has with the Nekeva. And that's what's able to extract the nefesh from the person and to plant it into the baby. And that nefesh is what gives the body, the new body, the life force, and allows it to grow. The power of the life force that the baby has is the life force of the parents. And it's extracted through that means. Shikoyach shaguf nivne mimenu, v'hu nimshech b'koyach or ha'nefesh shal hamoylidim. Ki b'koyach gadol tshukas hamalitim, shehi b'chinas haskama chazaka shelo, hey mamshichin mo'olam ha'asiyah haruchni asar ha'nefesh shel havlat. What happens is that this power, we know that the nefesh is partly physical, partly spiritual. Remember, we said that the nefesh is what connects the ruach to the guf. The body and the soul of a person, the neshama, is connected to Hashem all the way on the other end. A human being is like a chain, links of a chain. But the type of links that slowly blend from one to the next. We said it's like the spectrum of light. There's red on one end and violet on the other end. Red and violet have nothing in common. So red goes to orange, orange goes to yellow. The orange has something in common with the red and something in common with the yellow. So it's able to connect them. The yellow has something in common, green. It has something in common with the orange and something in common with the green. So it's able to connect it. The green has something in common with the blue and something in common with the purple. At the end of the day, the red and the purple are connected. It's the same thing with the guf and the neshama. The guf is at one end, and the neshama, which is connected to Hashem, is all the way on the other end. And they're these links of chains. And the nefesh is the thing that connects the physical body. The nefesh is the only part of the human soul that actually touches the body. Because look at the nefesh, let's say, is the orange. It's the only thing that can touch the red. And nothing else has a shaychus to the red. Nothing else has a shaychus to the guf. This nefesh is an incredible creation that it's able on one end to grasp the physical, on the other end it's able to grasp the ruach, which is a spiritual. And it goes more and more spiritual until it goes up to Hashem. So that nefesh is the koyach that's taken from the person that goes into the baby, that's able to pull that nefesh down from upstairs. Then the baby starts developing. From the nefesh it develops a ruach. The ruach it develops a neshama. Now even the neshama, contrary to popular belief, is not the same in every person. We build our neshama. Sure, we've all heard by bar mitzvahs, the speeches by bar mitzvahs, that the neshama goes into a person at his bar mitzvah. Or the Eitz HaToiv goes. That's true to an extent. There are many parts to a neshama. If a person is zoicha, if after he does mitzvahs, he gets more of a neshama. If a person is even more zoicha, the more mitzvahs a person does, the more he gets connected to up on high, and the stronger the link becomes between him and Hashem. And he kind of grows his neshama. The neshama, remember what the Ramchal said? The neshama is just a link, it's a circuit between him and the forces up high. And like anything else, the more you exercise your body, the stronger it becomes. And the more you exercise your neshama and feed your neshama, the stronger your neshama becomes. And just like a person can get more muscles and develop his muscles, a person can develop his neshama and get more neshama or more neshamois. It's just semantics. As he does mitzvahs. The neshama of a person that learns Torah is a totally different neshama than the neshama of a person that doesn't learn Torah. It says in the Zohar that Am Ha'aretz has no neshama. It doesn't mean he's a zombie, or maybe it does mean he's a zombie, in a different sense. It means that there's a level of neshama that person is missing, totally missing. A person that doesn't do mitzvahs has no neshama on certain levels. It's just missing. It's a different human being. The Magen Avraham, did I say this last week? No. The Magen Avraham, the Magen Avraham asks a question. La halacha lamaisa. Every day in the morning we make brachas. I said this last week? Last year. Okay. Every day in the morning we make brachas. Shelo yasani goy, shelo yasani oved, shelo yasani isha, right? The Magen Avraham has a question. He says, al pi halacha we should not be able to do that because if you make a bracha on something once, you don't make a bracha on it again unless there's a hefsek in between. You make a bracha on an apple, you can't make a bracha on the same apple. You can't even make a bracha on another apple if you eat it immediately afterwards. There has to be a hefsek between eatings, and then you can make a new bracha. So the question is, if I made a bracha yesterday, shloyos ani goy, how in the world can I make a bracha shloyos ani goy today? Where was the hefsek? It's the same apple. I'm the same person. I'm the same Jew. Once in your life you'll make a bracha shloyos ani goy, that's it. Where's the hefsek? Says the Magen Avraham. The neshama of a person goes up when he's sleeping. Part of the neshama, right? the neshama comes down. He says we make a bracha that it's the same neshama that came up, same neshama that came down as that which went up. We make a bracha that we did not receive the neshama of a goy, that we did not receive the neshama of an eved, that we did not receive the neshama of an isha. We are reborn every day with a, not a new neshama, it's the same neshama, but it was reinserted. And theoretically, we could have had the neshama of a goy, or the neshama of an isha, or the neshama of an eved. They have different neshamas. Why does an eved have a different neshama? I would imagine the reason is because he has a different set of mitzvahs. An eved is potter from one of the 613 mitzvahs, the mitzvah loisa say to marry shifcha. An eved is not commanded in that, so it's a different set of mitzvahs, it's a different neshama. But in any case, a person can lose his neshama. A person can get extra neshamas. Yeah. Yeah, well, how does the person... That's a good question. The simplest answer is that... I mean, some people will tell you, well, if you got the wrong neshama, you're not going to make the bracha. But I don't think that's the real answer. I think the real answer is that the question is a misunderstanding of the idea. It's not that you practically speaking, could get a new neshama. God doesn't do that. We have kind of a guarantee or surety that this is the way it works. You will always have the same neshama that went up. However, since you're reborn, it's a hefsik, and therefore you could make the bracha. It's not that, okay, well, thank God I got this neshama and not that neshama. It's the same make-believe you were born the first time and you knew what neshama you got. You make a bracha, let's say, one shloyas ani goy, if you were to be reborn, so to speak, even if you know what neshama you got, since you're reborn, it's like a hefsik. Even if you know you're going to eat an apple, you make a bracha. We know that we do get the same neshama, but it's a hefsik, we're reborn. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that, now theoretically, it's theoretical. What could happen? But we assume that we're getting the same neshama. That's all. Now, the halacha, the possibility is enough. The hefsek is enough, even if we're sure that we're getting the same neshama. But there are things that you could do to make you lose your neshama. Averis, chop off parts of your neshama. Very bad averis, chop off great parts of your neshama. To the point where a guy is ein lechelik li'olam haba means his neshama is dead. Nothing left of it. Nothing. It's gone. And apikiris, those type of evil people, they're mamish like animals. All they have is the nefesh habahamis. When they die, the nefesh habahamis goes down and there's nothing to go up. Everybody has a nefesh habahamis. It goes down, but there's a neshama that goes up. Somebody whose neshama is not, there's nothing left, that's it, it's goodbye. That's the worst of the worst. As a person steigs, as a person does mitzvahs, he develops his neshama. His neshama gets bigger and bigger, and he has more levels of neshama. There are certain levels, it says, that only Moshe Rabbeinu had. That nobody else can have, nobody else in the world ever had except Moshe Rabbeinu. Certain levels of neshama. So a person really is in charge of his neshama. It says in many, many chazals that a person is in charge. He controls how much neshama he has and what madregas of neshama he has. The nefesh and the ruach is all the same. And the neshama, that part of the nefesh habahamis, the neshama of the lower neshama that we're talking about, everybody's the same. But the nefesh al yoina, that depends on you. When a person's, by a bris milah, a person gets part of it. By a bar mitzvah, he gets an extra part of it. Later on, he gets more parts of it. And the reason why they say that he gets the Yetzer Toiv at the Bar Mitzvah is because the Neshama is the Yetzer Toiv. A human being, we said this many times, is a strange thing. Imagine two people. It would be a good plot for a Purim play. Two people handcuffed together. One guy, I don't know, a motorcycle bum. Handcuffed to a little yeshivish guy that always learns in Beis Medrash 24/7. Imagine that. They're handcuffed and they can't get away from each other. So imagine this guy's pulling the other guy to the movies. This guy's pulling the motorcycle guy. That's a human being. The motorcycle guy, that is the guf and the nefesh habahamis. The yeshivish guy, that's the neshama ha'elyona. Now, where are you? Your identity? You're the handcuffs. And you could pull back. You could nurture one side of you to make it stronger. You could nurture the other side of you. But at the end of the day, one of those two people are going to win. And also, as we said, there are two ways to win a tug of war. Now, forget the handcuffs. I'll use a different motion. Regular tug of war, there are two ways to win. You can either pull the other guy to your side, or you could let go of the rope. If the guf wins and the neshama loses, it's because the neshama let go of the rope. The guf doesn't become physical. The neshama doesn't become physical. If the neshama wins, it pulls the guf all the way to the spiritual side, and the guf becomes holy. Just like there are people who had neshamas that nobody else ever had, because the neshamas were on such high levels that nobody else ever had it. There are people whose bodies were on such high levels that they were different than everybody else. Eliyahu HaNavi went up to Shemayim alive. His body went up to Shemayim alive. Why? Because his body, he took that motorcycle bump and he brought it to the Beis Medrash so often. He just beat it so often that you know what happened? Started learning Torah. And it started learning Torah, so first it got rid of its leather jacket. I mean, Eliyahu HaNavi wore a leather jacket, you know. It says, Nevi'im in the olden days used to wear leather coats because it was cheap. It was much more expensive to weave fabric. So it was the least gashmiest stick of beged, so he used to wear it. But the motorcycle first got rid of the leather jacket, then it got rid of the motorcycle, put on a hat, put on a suit, put on a white shirt, bought a Gemara. First it started off with an art scroll, then it learned how to learn on its own, and then went to Rishonim and Achronim, and before you know it, you mamish have two neshamas. You know, Rashi and Zechariah says, Rashi and Sefer Zechariah, that bizchus limud ha-Torah, a person is zoicha to two yetzer toivs. The yetzer hara becomes a yetzer toiv. The bechira is to make it into the Yetzer Tov. At that point, it could be you don't have. It could be at the end, Tosfos asks the kasha. It says that after a certain level, there are certain people, Avram Avinu, for instance, that shechted his Yetzer Hara, took a knife and boom, shechted the Yetzer Hara. And Tosfos asks, where's the bechira? He says, one of the answers is that you may not have bechira at that point, but because you brought yourself to that point, you get reward as if it, not as if, you get reward because you did it all on your own. If a person brings himself to the point where he literally slapped up he beat the living daylights out of his Yetzer Hara to the point where his Yetzer Hara is subservient to him, and his Yetzer Hara mamish listens to his Yetzer Tov, then he gets credit for that. That was his doing. That was his doing. And even though at a certain point in time, he's home free, his Yetzer, but you know how much work he put in to get there? And therefore, the person gets credit, mamish, for every mitzvah, as if he did it on his own. You know? Let's say you have a guy, it's a very simple concept. Let's say you have a guy walks down the street on Mott Avenue, and when he hits the corner, Beach Channel Drive, he's surrounded by the Yetzer Hara. He has McDonald's on one side, and White Castle on the other side. Mamish, stereophonic, Sutton. And he has the Yetzer Hara surrounding him. And in the summer he has the Galach also. Over there, you know. There's a Galach over there set up. Darshan's a Magid. So Mamish, the Yetzer Hara is all over the place. And the first time he goes, you know, he's tempted. He has to go into McDonald's. Turns around. Turns his back to McDonald's, he opens his eyes, there's White Castle over there. Turns around, turns his back to White Castle, forces himself, opens his eyes, there's the Galach. And mamish, wherever he goes, he's beset by the Yetzer Hara, but he runs away into the A-train, into the safety of the spiritual environment, away from the Yetzer Hara. The second time he walks down Mott Avenue, it's a little easier. Third time it's a little to the point where he walks down, he's not tempted anymore. You think he doesn't get reward, because now he has no Yetzer Hara to go in? Of course he gets reward, because he brought himself to that level. He's entitled to reap the rewards of being on that level. And so if a person does the same thing, I mean, who in the world, what person in the right mind has the Yetzer Hara for that Galach? The Yetzer Hara to walk into White Castle. Never mind the Olam HaBo, you ruin your Olam HaZeh. But if you're like Avram Avinu, to whom every Yetzirah in the world was White Castle, was laughable, you deserve reward and you get reward. And that's what it is. The neshama and the guf are connected through that chain. The nefesh, ruach, neshama, the guf, the spiritual and the physical are connected. And the miracle of Bechira is that we could take the physical and make it spiritual. We could take the spiritual, not really make it physical, but we could get rid of it and become totally physical. We could become literally animals if we want. And a person, he's an animal, that's all. And as Rashi and Zechariah, it's very interesting, there's a vort that I saw that it says, says the Gemara Zuminus, it's apikorsis. And Rashi says, it's not apikorsis, a guy doesn't believe in God. It's apikorsis megalaponim b'toyra shloika halacha. A guy twists toyra into apikorsis of things. It says, moitzio is divrei toyra l'divrei havoy, I think his lashon is Rashi. It's Rashi in the Gemara and Brachas. So the question is, why didn't Rashi say the simple meaning, l'isusurach v'ilvavchem it's apikorsis? So Teretz is, because we know that it says, v'yahavta as Hashem alekecha b'chol levavcha. Levavcha, two vases, means your yetzah tov and your yetzah hara. You have to serve God with your yetzah hara. And we know exactly what it means now, right? So when it says, l'isusurach v'ilvavchem, it doesn't say libchem. Just like you can serve God with your Yetzah Hara, Lo Yisusurach Relevavchem means serve the Satan with your Yetzah Toiv. It also has Yetzah Toiv and Yetzah Hara in there. So how do you take your Yetzah Toiv, your desire for Torah, and make it evil? That's what Rashi says, Megal Panim B'Torah Shloi Ka'alocha. That he learns Torah, but he brings the Torah into the side of evil. So you can take the Yetzah Hara and serve God with it, or you can take the Yetzer Toiv and serve the Satan with it. And serve the physical goof with it. And it's up to us. That's us in between. We're like the handcuffs. We can pull back on either side. Says the Zohar. If a person is Zoiche to those three madregas, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, oz nikra ha'odam b'shem kadosh. A person is considered called holy when he's zoicha to a certain madrega of having a neshama. Nefesh, ruach, and neshama, different madregas. Tochozi says the Zohar, odam kishenoylad noisim loy nefesh, mishat mitzad ha'behema. When a person is born, we give him a nefesh ha'bahamis. Zocha yoiser. If he zoich a little more, noisim loy ruach, mitzad chayos hakodesh. Zocha yoise, noisim loy neshama, mitzad hakisei. The more person zoich, the more neshama he gets. Now, having said this, understanding the relationship between the guf and the neshama, we continue. We have to really focus and understand the fact that on one hand, we're saying that we possess a tzelem alaykim, and chelik alaykam imal and neshama that's so high that only God has the right to have that power. On the other hand, we say we have a body that's connected to the neshama and a nefesh ha-bahamis that's mamish like an animal. And through the links of these chains, those two are connected. That's an amazing thing. Mamish, an amazing thing. Now let's continue in the Ramchal. Nimso haguf at the end of this paragraph, and nimso haguf ishtei neshomais miskashrim ze en ze. The neshoma and the guf are connected to each other. He just said, nefesh hazois miskasheris batachtoina vahatachtoina b'chelik hayois adak shebedam. The physical body is connected to the lowest level of neshoma, but in a particular place. The most spiritual part of a The most physical part of neshama is the nefesh habahamis, and the most spiritual part of a human body is the dam. Now, there are halachas that are nageya to this. The Ramban says that the reason why we're not allowed to eat dam is because the blood is the maimid lanefesh. Ki nefesh kol basar damoy benafshayhu. Because the blood is the receptacle, is the place of the nefesh, that's why we're not allowed to eat it. It says also that if you eat the blood of an animal, so then the actual midas, if you can call it that, the nature of the animal actually affects you. Because you are eating now not just the physical, the cells of the animal, but you're eating the spiritual part of the animal, the nefesh habahamis of the animal, if you're eating its blood. That's why we have to extract the blood. And related to the Isser of blood is the Isser of Tsar Balei Chayim, they say. Since blood is off limits to us, and the reason why the blood is off limits to us is not like for the platelets, for the physical blood. The reason why animal blood is off limits to us is because that's where the nefesh of the animal is. Which means the nefesh of the animal is not within, was not given to us, is not within our domain. Tsar Balei Chayim would mean that you controlled, you violated, you conquered, you took power over the nefesh part of the animal. Because we said the person's feelings, his pain and pleasure, is the product of the nefesh habahamis. And the nefesh habahamis of an animal is something off limits to us, both in terms of us eating it and in terms of us controlling it. That's what Tsar Balei Chayim, that's the understanding of the Yisr of Tsar Balei Chayim. Vihine mimnei hakesher hazeh shenikshares nefesh zois baguf al yidei nefesh hatachtoina. Because the nefesh is connected to the guf, the neshama is connected to the guf through this intermediate soul, this life force, this nefesh habahamis, nimtzis mugbelis begvulois protium. A neshama has a lot of freedom. It can do many things. It can act certain ways. However, when it's connected, it's handcuffed to the guf, or handcuffed to the nefesh habahamis, it's kind of tied down, like it has a ball and chain. Like this yeshiva guy who's connected by handcuff to this motorcycle guy, there's certain things he can't do. And there's certain things that the neshama can't do because it's connected to this physical entity. Wherever the neshama goes, or wherever it tries to go, wherever a physical entity can't go, the neshama can't go. Now, to some extent that's true, and to some extent it's not. We're going to see what the neshama can do while it's in the guf, and what the neshama needs to be separate from the guf in order to do. Nimna mimenu ha-hishtatfus v'ha-esik in ha-nimtsoyim ha-ruchniyim v'nivdolim. The neshama, as long as it's caged and locked up in the body, is prevented from socializing and having business with the spiritual entities, the non-physical entities that exist. Kolzman heyoysim is kasherisim haguf. As long as it's bound and attached to the body. Dahainu, namely, kol yimei chayei ha'odom. As long as all the years, the life of a person. This is what it means when Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, lo yireini odom v'choy. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, hareini nos kvaydecha to Hashem, please show me your glory. There are a lot of explanations as to what this means, but one of them simply is that Hashem answered, lo yireini odom v'choy, that a person can't see me and live, meaning he told Moshe Rabbeinu, the spiritual visions that you want to have could be had by your neshama, but your neshama is blinded and is bound to the guf. And as long as it's enchained and shackled by the guf, there's no way that you, your neshama, could have those experiences that you're asking for, to see the glory of Hashem. Lo yireini odom v'choy, as long as a person is alive, meaning that his neshama, what does alive mean? A person's guf is connected to a neshama. As long as your neshama is connected to your guf, there's no way you're going to be able to see this. When your neshama is no longer connected to your guf, then you'll be able to see it. I read you the Orachaim HaKadosh, what he says. Yesh l'cho l'das, you should know. Ki ha-gashmius yisnaged l'chibur ha-ruchni. Gashmius is repugnant to being connected to Ruchnius. Gashmius and Ruchnius are like the two positive magnetic fields, right? The two positives repel each other. It repels, the Gashmius and the Ruchnius repel each other, like oil and vinegar. Yoisameha hisnagdus eish umayim. More than the incompatibility. Yust chachma, ubora ha'odam, machoin ha'rishoin shehu ha'nefesh. Shein ba elochelik muetz maharuchnius. He created a nefesh that only has a small, small amount of ruchnius in it. V'hashora b'toichoi b'chino el yoina mima shehi b'chinas haruach. Mimeno shehi b'chinas haruach. He connected it to something a bit more spiritual. That's the ruach. V'nimtzas ha-nefesh m'mutza b'in ha-guf u'b'in ha-ruach. The nefesh is the connecting factor. It's the go-between, the median between the guf and the ruach. Ki ein ha-ruach oimid b'geshem elo emtzius ha-beloi emtzius ha-guf emtzius ha-nefesh. The ruach cannot exist in a physical body if you take away the nefesh. Because the ruach, imagine you're holding one of those helium balloons. That string is what connects you to that balloon. If you take away that string, that balloon goes up. That string is like the nefesh. The balloon's like the ruach. The guf is holding, is connected to the ruach by that string. You take away the nefesh, the ruach disappears. And that balloon is a mumutzan in between a different balloon. Without a ruach, a neshama couldn't be in a body. Relative to the guf, the nefesh is spiritual. Relative to the ruach, the ruach is spiritual. Relative to the neshama. Relative to the ruach, the neshama is spiritual. But each one's connected to the other. V'chein neshama, m'mutza bein ha-ruach ha-bein ha-neshama l'neshama. The nefesh ha-al-yoyna, sometimes they call neshama l'neshama. Nimtza soima ki ha-nefesh yichoyla amud levada v'ha-ruach b'beiz, ha-neshama v'gimel v'neshama l'neshama b'dalad. The Zohar says that when the neshama goes into the guf, it can get bigger when a person does mitzvahs. But when the neshama leaves the guf, it suddenly gets bigger than it ever could have been while it's in the guf. And it suddenly attains the ability to be masik, to understand things that it previously could not have been masik. We know from many places in Chazal and many Sfarim that what a person is in this world, that's what he remains in the next world. If you want to know what you are in the next world, what you were that moment that you died, at that moment, that's what you are forever. You're locked in. What a person is, the moment he dies, whatever madrega he's on, that's what a person is forever. To the point where, you know, the Gemara says that when Unculus wanted to convert, so his uncle Titus came to him and said, Unculus, don't convert. It's very bad to be Jewish. Now, problem is that Unculus' uncle Titus was dead at the time. And he came to him in a vision. And the question is, Titus was already in Gehenna a very, very long time. Why didn't he learn his lesson already? Isn't he in the Olam HaEmes? The answer is, if you're in the Olam HaEmes, even if you see the truth, you won't know it. You won't absorb it. It won't change you. That's the Gehenna. You're in the Olam HaEmes and you're still insisting on Sheker. If you're in this world and you're insisting on Sheker, you can get away with it. But if you're the Olam HaEmes and you're still spouting Sheker, then that's the Gehenna. If you had an attitude on this world, you can't change it in the next world. Now there's Gemara Brachos where it says a story of a guy that got kicked out of his house by his wife right before Yom Kippur and he slept in a cemetery. And he heard the spirits talking. And one spirit said something like, let's go haunt the world. And the other said, we can't haunt the world because we're not dressed properly. The tachrichim aren't social garments. Not socially acceptable. And the pshat is, because whatever attitudes we had in Olam Hazeh, we remain with in Olam Haba. We do not change our attitudes. Period. However, there are certain attitudes that we get in Olam Hazeh that affect our neshama, that because the neshama is bound to the guf, it can't bring it out. It's only potential, not actual. And when the neshama is free of the guf, that those pieces of information attain actuality, not only potential. Like it says that people that support Torah in this world, when they get to Olam Haba, so they're going to understand the Torah. If you support somebody that he should be able to learn the Ketzos HaChoshen, in Olam Haba you'll be able to learn the Ketzos HaChoshen. And the way this works is that through your action you attain some spiritual potential, that because you're in Olam Hazeh, it doesn't really bring itself to actuality, doesn't bring itself to fruition. But in Olam Haba, when your guf is no longer an obstacle to the neshama freeing itself, the neshama is able to experience those things that was always frustrated, kind of frustrated, that was always encumbered in Olam Hazeh. So, we continue. Umispaeles mimai se haguf. The neshama, the lowest neshama, is impacted by the actions of the body. Well, and it in turn impacts on the higher neshama, and the domino effect goes all the way to the highest neshama. L'hiskasher al yodom ba'or ha'boyre yizbarach. The highest neshama ends up affecting, ends up being connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Based on your actions, your physical actions, you can control your neshama, whether your neshama connects to Hashem, or whether your neshama disengages, disconnects from Hashem, and connects to the koiches hatumah. And your neshama gets conditioned based on the subtotal of all your actions in this world. Ubezet toloi, one day when Mashiach comes, this is the Ramchal Shita, Olam Haba, when Mashiach comes, one day when Mashiach comes, the body and the neshama is going to be together and we're going to be either prepared for the reward or not prepared. And whether the neshama is prepared for the reward depends only upon what the guf did to it. V'poyelas ba'odam, ומנהגס את הנפש התחתונה, ומדריכתו, וחוקקס בו ציורי השכלה לפי הכנוסו, ומילדס בו המחשבות והרצון כפי צרה שעשית לוי. The guf and the neshama interact with each other. There are certain desires a person has that affect the neshama that originate in the guf, and certain desires that the guf have that has that originate in the neshama. For example, it's a famous medrash. It's on a pasuk in Koheles. Pasuk says, "Kol yimei oni royim v'." No. Kol omol nefesh lefihu, kol omol odom lefihu v'gam hanefesh loisimolei. Everything, all the food, everything a person works for in this world, goes to work every day, it's all to feed his body. And the neshama, the nefesh, isn't satiated from the food. That's what the pasuk tells us. And the Medrash says, I'll give you a moshel to explain what's going on. It says, moshel aruni shenasabas malachim. It's a moshel for a caveman that married a princess. And the caveman has a certain standard, and the princess has a certain standard. And whatever the caveman tries to get the princess is not going to be happy. Now just imagine, caveman marries a princess, they go live in the cave. The princess is very romantic, of course. It wasn't a shadchan that set them up. Cave princess decided she's going to marry this peasant, it's going to be really, really nice, and maybe she's going to be rebellious. She ends up living in a cave, And before she knows it, she has problems because she's used to sleeping in silks and linens and thick mattresses, and suddenly she's sleeping on a stone cave, and it smells, and it's hard, and it's cold. And her husband, the caveman, he wants to make things comfortable for her, so he gives her caveman comforts. A dead rabbit, a bloody necklace for jewelry, and all of these things that cavemen are used to. Maybe he'll even buy her a club, you know, to hit things over the head. And that's what cavemen are used to. And the more he buys her, the more she's gonna feel. Because she remembers what she's used to, and she's sad, and it just makes it worse. It just rubs in the fact that now she's living in a cave and not a palace. And that's what it means when the guf and the neshama get together. First we said it's like two people handcuffed. Then we said a tug of war. And now the Medrash is telling us another mashal, a caveman married to a princess. The caveman is the guf, the princess is the neshama. And here we have another aspect of it, where the motorcycle guy and the yeshiva guy who are handcuffed to each other, they have to get along with each other. They're married to each other. And the motorcycle guy sees that the yeshiva guy is unhappy, because he's always driving around with the motorcycle gang, and he wants to make him feel good. So he buys him, I don't know, a chain. And he says, here, look, it's a chain, you can hit people with it. And the tzaddik on the other end of the handcuffs is like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with this? What did I get myself into? And the motorcycle guy says, all right, a chain is not good enough. I'll buy you, what else is there to buy? I don't know, a Harley. He's buying a Harley for the guy. He says, what am I going to do with this? And the more the caveman buys, the worse it gets. Now, you think the opposite is also not true? The tzaddik on one hand of the handcuff sees that the motorcycle guy isn't happy, so he buys him a safer. So what do you think he's going to do with a safer? That's the caveman and the peasants married to each other. The caveman and the princess. The caveman tries to make the princess happy, it doesn't work, and the princess and vice versa. Sooner or later, one of two things are going to happen. Either the caveman is going to become a princess, or the princess is going to become a caveman. And that's what it means. The guf and the neshama are going to either be fighting with each other all their life, or they're going to influence each other, and that's going to determine the person. And what's more is that the Medrash says that the human being is not really two. You're really one person. And now we feel in ourselves sometimes the caveman, and sometimes we feel the princess. The princess wants Torah and mitzvahs. In one place it says wants Torah exclusively, more than mitzvahs. Torah is on a much more spiritual level than all the rest of the mitzvahs. All the rest. The neshama wants to learn Torah. That's a thing it wants more than anything else. That's the Sili Pastropedic mattress that it had in the palace. That's the drapes. That's the linen. That's the servants, the gold, the silver. It's the neshama only wants Torah. The guf feels that. And here's a psychology lesson from Chazal. You know why people are crazy? Animals aren't crazy. I'm not talking about mad cow disease. I'm talking about psychological problems. Animals don't have psychological problems. Animals don't have psychological aspirations. You have a cow, you give him some food, some water, a nice shady spot under a tree, and he's happy for the rest of his life. Human beings want more. They have to be the richest, they have to be famous, they have to be powerful, they have to be successful. That's a very strange thing. You ask some atheist, some evolutionist, that'll tell you that as the species continue to develop, they get more and more suited for survival. That was fine until a person was a cow. Then when the cows or the monkeys became human beings, they became less suited for survival, because monkeys don't commit suicide when they're depressed. Monkeys don't go to psychologists. Monkeys don't need all these things. The more you need, the less suited you are. If you need things that are useful for your survival, like food and water, and you have an instinct to go out after them, that's fine. But the instinct that people have, the burning desire to be the best and the most and to be famous, could somebody tell me in the evolutionary development of a person, how in the world did he ever develop this nonsensical urge that he has to be famous? Travel. People like to travel from place to place. You ever see a monkey that wanted to go, like, from one forest to another forest because, you know, he just wants to see what's going on in the world? No, it's all the same thing. These trees, those trees. People in New York They want to go see Paris. People in Paris, you get off on the in Penn Station, you see these people from Switzerland and Germany taking pictures of Macy's. What are they doing? Because they're from Switzerland and Germany. They want to go. People from New York want to go to Switzerland and Germany. Can anybody explain to me the evolutionary development of man, how this urge to travel contributes to the survival of the species? Like, why didn't we lose this when we were in the Paramecium stage or something? How did we get this? How did this happen? Monkeys don't have it. Something went wrong in this cheshbon. Well, the answer, well, we know the answer. The answer is, this is not the goof, this is the neshama talking. This is the neshama. This is not a physical urge. It's not a physical desire. There's no physical benefit that a person has through traveling, through becoming famous, through becoming rich, through becoming glorified. A person stands on stage and everybody claps. He now made it. He got his Oscar. What in the world does that do for his physical well-being? And if he gets his Oscar, he's not going to be happy anyway. He wants something more, right? Oy, if kesef lo yizba kesef. Somebody that has 1,000 wants 2,000. Had a friend, I said this over many times. Have a friend. Married a very, very wealthy girl. Very, very wealthy girl. Very wealthy. Like, billionaire. And his father-in-law, not around anymore, the father-in-law woke up 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, came home 11 o'clock at night from work. And mamish, like he had more money than all the generations of his family are ever going to need. But he mamish, he worked and he worked and he worked and he worked. And my friend, he asked him, he said, when are you going to retire? He said, when I'm bigger than Edgar Bronfman. That's what he said. So now, this urge that a person has to be bigger than Edgar Bronfman, how did that develop? The answer is, that's the neshama. Because imagine this princess and this caveman. Remember, the princess is crying, and the caveman doesn't understand. The caveman's misinterpreting, because the caveman's a low-level intellect, and it tries to satiate and satisfy the princess's emptiness and the princess's desires by bringing it caveman stuff. The princess wants silks, and the caveman's bringing it loincloths. And the more the princess cries, the more the caveman is frustrated, and the more the caveman, he's a good husband, he tries to satisfy the wife, and the wife, the more the caveman tries, the more she gets frustrated, and it's just not working because they're not communicating. So too, the neshama tells the guf, it cries, it goes to Olam Hazeh, I want Torah. Also mitzvahs. But mainly I want to learn Torah. The guf feels that emptiness. Animals don't have this urge. The guf feels that emptiness. And it's not food, it's not water, it knows that there's something there that it can't just put its finger on. So the guf says, I know what I'm going to give this spiritual desire, this spiritual burning. Fame, fortune, travel, power, I'm going to be the best, the richest. It tries all these things in order to satiate the neshama's desire for Torah. And it won't happen. The more it tries to satiate the princess, the more the princess gets frustrated. The more the princess gets frustrated, the more the guf tries. If a person has a million, he wants 10 million. 10 million, 20 million. He wants to be the most famous. This is all trying to satisfy the neshama. Animals that don't have a neshama don't have these problems. Only people have these problems. Only people have these desires for these spiritual kind of attainments. And that's because we are misdirecting our spiritual urges. The spiritual urges are satiated through Torah. Somebody that understands that and satiates his urges with Torah and mitzvahs, not going to need any of this stuff. To the extent that you satisfy your spirits with real spiritual things, real spiritual food, to that extent the princess is going to be happy. So the guf and the neshama feel each other. They just sometimes miscommunicate, and that's why people kind of go crazy. If there are more balei tshuva amongst like crazy college kids than there are normal middle-aged people. If you have two people, one's, let's say, a certified public accountant. He's wearing a yellow tie and a pocket protector. 40 years old, 50 years old, right? An intelligent guy, educated guy. And sitting next to him, let's say on the bus, some crazy college kid, A hippie. A guy, you know, with his long hair and a skateboard in his back pocket. Who do you think the odds are if one of them are going to become Baal Tshuva? Which one is it going to be? It's going to be a crazy college kid. That's the way it is. Ask anybody that's involved in making Baal Tshuvas, the spiritual seekers are the ones who it's easier to make them do tshuva. Those are the odds. And the reason is because once this princess is satisfied and becomes a caveman, it's harder to bring her back to be a princess. As long as she's throwing pots and pans at this guy, at her husband the caveman, as long as she's frustrated, and as long as her neshama, as long as her desire to be a princess is still there, and as long as she's frustrated, the easier it is to give her the silks and the linens. But once she becomes a caveman and is happy and resigns to live in a cave the rest of her life, yes, it's true. You could awaken her memory and jog her memory and say, remember what you used to be? Enough of this nonsense. Go back to the palace. Go back to the... But it's very, very likely that she'll say, you know what? I'm happy where I am. Leave me alone. I don't need anything. Somebody who needs things, who's looking for some kind of spirituality, which is what they call it, don't ask me why, who's looking for some kind of spirituality, even if it's misdirected, it's easier to tell them, okay, I'm going to direct what you have, rather than take the extra step of having to awaken the desire for spirituality. On the other hand, if you have a different approach, you know, maybe you can get the certified public accountant too. But those people that deal in these things say it's easier to get the crazy people. And we say crazy, what does it mean crazy? If this princess, in the early stages of her marriage, she acts crazy, she's frustrated, she was banging her head against the wall. And then 20 years later, she's a caveman in a loincloth with a club, banging rabbits over the head. When was she crazy and when was she normal? You know? When somebody gets satisfied in Olam Hazeh and resigns themselves to spend the rest of their life as a caveman, so they seem normal on the outside, but if you really understand what a human being is, it's not normal. That's the relationship between the guf and the shom. At this point, are there any questions? Yes? Right. The question, what about the goyim? The goyim don't have the desire for Torah, but they still seek fame and fortune. The answer is, the goyim do have a desire for spirituality, not as, they have 7 things that they need, not 613. And even though they're not supposed to learn Torah as such, they still have a neshama, not the same as a Jew's neshama, absolutely not. It's 2 totally different neshamas, but it's more than what an animal has. Remember, Vayipach Biapov Nishmas Chayim is referring to Odom HaRishon, from whom is descended even Goyim. Now, as I said this week and last week, you can do a lot of damage to your neshama, you can do violence to your neshama, and as generations go by, you could really decimate it. And especially after Kabbalah HaTorah, after Avram Avinu, we're going to see what happens to the human species after Adam HaRishon was born. It changed a lot. There are a lot of decisions that were made by humans that made permanent changes in the human spiritual makeup. And Goyim surely do not have the same neshama as Yidden, but they also don't have the same neshama as animals. Yeah?
You talk about free will being a response. God created us, implies that God created free will, which implies that our free will is not the same as God's free will. So we make the same cause.
Well, right. You see, that's true. The question is, God created free will. We said before that free will is the first cause, but the question is God created free will, so God is the cause of free will. That's true to an extent, because we are not God.
I can just
go ahead.
And our free will is limited to the extent that we, God can do, I guess, wherever he wants. Whereas our free will, God has stated to us, God guaranteed that we cannot destroy the world. God will prevent us from doing that. In a sense, God has limited all.
God can control our free will. He can take it away if he wants to. Right.
Right. In that sense, our free will is limited, not the same as God's free will.
Right.
In that sense, it's the second cause.
Right. It's true. Our free will, when we say our free will is a first cause, right, we don't mean that it's the same as God. I mean, if our free will would be the same as God, a first cause, we know all first causes are also invulnerable to any effects. Because if you have nothing caused you, nothing could impact on you. Which is why nothing can change or impact on God. However, our free will is susceptible to God's manipulations. It's also susceptible even to our environment, everything, a lot of things. That's what happened to Paro, and it happened to other people too. So it's true that we are not God. We are not God. There's only one God. But, but all that having been said, we as human beings, as creations, should not, al pi derech hateva, be entitled even to the measure of freedom that we enjoy. To be able to choose without a cause, that can't be. You cannot choose without a cause, al pi derech hateva. There has to be a cause for your choice. And it's true that we're not God, our bechira is not the same as God, but our bechira should not exist, al pi derech hateva, because you cannot choose unless there's a reason for your choice. What caused your choice? That's the thing. It's when we say Tzelem Elokim, it's like an image of God, kind of a reflection, kind of a pale reflection, kind of something that looks as if it was something, a similarity type thing. It's not even similarity. It's more like analogous, or like we share something, or God has granted us something that comes from him in some kind of way. But it's true that our cause is, our free will is vulnerable, it's susceptible, you can impact on it, you can affect it, which puts it in a completely different category than God's free will. However, it's also not in the same category as nature. And in that sense, it's Tzelem Elokim. You know, Tzelem is not the same as the real thing either. It just means it's a similar. Yeah, well, the question, it's a pretty old question, pretty famous question. God knows the future, he knows what we're going to choose. Does that not mean that God made it happen? So I'll give you the easy answer. The easy answer is no. Let's give you a simple moshel. Let's say you were to go in a time machine into the future and see everything that happens in the future. And you come back and give us a report of everything that's going to happen into the future. Does that mean you caused it to happen? No. It means that you were able to see it. If, let's say, we would have some miracle and you would find a newspaper for next week's newspaper today, and you see that some guy murdered somebody else. So you know for a fact that that's going to happen. It's unchangeable. Does that mean you in any way, form, or shape whatsoever caused that? Does that mean that the fact that you knew that, does that mean the fact that you know that means the guy didn't have bechira when he murdered the guy anymore because you saw it? The answer is no. You have to look at past, present, and future. Where God is concerned, as God has all the future newspapers. God looks into the crystal ball. God has the time machine. God knows what you're going to choose because he knows that you chose it. To God, he can jump to the past, the present, to the future, the same way you could jump from one place to another. Kivyochel. All of history, imagine like this, from past, present, and future, like a lot of cells in a spreadsheet. It's just that we only experience one at a time. God has the whole spreadsheet in front of him. And he can look over there and see who killed who. Right. He doesn't cause that. You chose it. He doesn't cause it. Doesn't cause it. Now there's a question on this. This is my son's question. Okay, well, very, very good question. He said, if this is true, that God knows the future the same way he knows the past, and says that, Tosis Yom Tov brings it, a lot of people say this, then would God be able to know a theoretical future? Meaning, God says, well, if I create the world this way, then that's going to happen. or if I do this, then that's going to happen. Something that God decided not to do because of future ramifications, which in the bottom line, ultimately, it never happened even in the future. Which means that God must have another way of knowing the future, besides the fact that the future happened, as far as God's concerned, because if God only knows the future because he sees it in the future, then what if that future ultimately will never happen? How is God able to know that? That's a good question. My son's question. He brought that up. Yeah, I understand, except the problem is, when you say there are several futures out there, what reality do those futures have if they never happen? If they happen. If they don't happen, then what reality do they have? Yoina. Oh, so see, that's where this whole thing came up. The Or Sameach has a question. He says, why does Hashem send a Navi to tell people to do tshuva in a case where he knows they're not going to do tshuva anyway? Like, what's the point? God's not obligated to send a Navi. And if he knows the Navi's not going to be successful, so what's the point? Why? He can punish them without a Navi. A Navi is kind of a privilege or an extra warning, right? So it's not like legally or halachically he had to send a Navi or there's some reason from that angle. The only conceivable reason that we could think of for God to send a Navi is the possibility that the people will do tshuva. But if God knows they're not going to tshuva, then why send a Navi? So my son answered, okay, very funny. So then what are you going to say, don't send a Navi? So then how are you going to know they're not going to do tshuva? Now, how do you know that if you would have sent a Navi, they wouldn't have done tshuva? The answer is that obviously God knows not only the future that actually will happen, but all possible futures, even if they don't happen. And that's a problem. That's a problem. See, the problem is because whatever mechanism that we understand that God is able to know the future would mean that people are locked in. See, the reason why the Rambam asked this question, everybody knows that. The Rambam asked this question. Now, the Ravid answers what I said. He said it's like the stargazers. You look in the stars. I say a crystal ball. I say a newspaper. He says you look in the stars. That's his moshel. And you see the future. So what's the big deal? God sees the future. That's what the Ravid says. Now, the Rambam says, of course, you can't even ask the question because when you say, how does God know something? It's you asking what God is, because God and his knowledge is one, and beyond time, beyond space, it's more than beyond time and beyond space, it's like, we have no idea what he is at all. And therefore we have no idea how God knows something. Which is fine, you can say that, you can say that the question is not valid, because the question is the same as saying, well, what is God? Same as saying, how does God know? However, if you're going to accept the question, like the Ravid accepts the question, like other Rishonim accept the question, and you're going to answer, and this is the answer, that to God is beyond time, so past, present, and future is all visible to him at once, that's not good enough. Because, you see, the reason why this answers the question, the reason why that answer is good, the reason why, if you see next week's newspaper, it doesn't mean that the person lacked Bechira, is simply because if I know something that happens in the future and then it happens, which happened first? The fact that I know it or it happening? Well, I knew it first. It happened later and I knew it before. So if I knew it first and it happened later, that means its happening could not be the cause of me knowing. I have to know based on a cause that exists now. The answer is no. God is able to see into the future such that your doing it is the reason why God knows. God is not bound by the fact that something didn't happen yet. God sees the future the same way we see the past. God sees what you did and what you will do in the same way. So it's like God looks into the future, you did it, God saw, God hops, skips back into the past, and now God knows the future. Look at it this way. Never mind the future. Imagine if you can go back into the past. and you go back to the days of George Washington, you tell everybody what's going to happen in the next 200 years. 225 years. When I started saying this, Marshall, I used to say 200 years because it was like a while ago. But now it's already a long time. 225 years, okay? And you're telling everybody. You went back in the past, Shanu Shamayim. That means you knew the future. Is that possible? You knew the future because now you went back in the past. So imagine when God knows the future, it's not that he knows the future. It's that God went back in the past. We are now in the days of George Washington. And God knows God went back in the past because he already experienced the future, kind of. So, like, we shouldn't be so arrogant to think that, like, we are it and the future didn't happen yet. That's true from our perspective. But from God's perspective, the future happened yet, and he kind of goes back in the past to our days. We're, like, back in the past. We're not in the future, you know. If you have those stories with time machines, past, present, and future, you hop, skip, and jump from one year to the next, which year is really happening? So, I don't know. You got to ask the science fiction writer, but as far as God's concerned, it's all the same.
Did you not argue that there is a dual control? I mean, we're controlled. We're like TV. Mind control is force control. Even though it's mind control, but the force control, vice versa, whatever. No, we're both co-deciders of what happens.
Question. We're co-deciders in what happens, but I get full reward or punishment. Okay. So, without God deciding, would I have murdered the guy? Without God deciding that I would. You see, if God knows my own Bechira, if God knows my Bechira, that means whatever portion of Bechira I have, that's the problem. You see, but right. Okay, good. So, but God knew what I would say before I did it. So the question just comes back. You see, there's an answer by Rabbi Chanan, which is very interesting, kind of like one of these unending thoughts. Rabbi Chanan answers the question. He says, I don't understand what the question is. He says, if let's say somebody wants to eat treif, right? And then you put a gun to his head and say, eat that treif or I'll kill you. And he eats the treif. Is he potter or chayev? He's chayev. Because your forcing him did not add anything to his free will. He would have done it anyway. So Rabbi Chanan says, yes, God knows what a person would do, and let's assume even that God's knowledge forces a guy. But he would have done it anyway. If he would have done it anyway, he's responsible. That's all. He says, so God put a gun to the guy's head. Good. But the guy wanted to do it. Now the problem with this is, you can ask, God forces you to do what you would have done anyway. Because, but he was saying even if it's not free, you would be responsible if you would have done it anyway because you chose. See, the problem is that God knew of your choice also. God knew what you would have done anyway. Well, the fact that it's preceded by a prior cause, that is a good problem, but the answer is that, okay, so we'll say it's a miracle. That's easy. Determinists don't believe in miracles. And the truth of the matter is, I don't understand these determinists. You know why? Can I tell you why? Because their decision that there's no free will was also predetermined, which means it may not be right or wrong. In other words, they were forced to think that. So what good is it? What good is a thought? What good is a thought that had a prior cause? It's not as if they had a choice. If, let's say, they would be wrong, determinism would be wrong, would they believe it's wrong? No. Because according to them, there's a predetermined reason why they decided to be determinists. So what good is such a philosophical conclusion if it was forced? It didn't come from them. It's a paradox. It's an oxymoron to say that I decided that nobody can decide anything, which is what they're doing. So goodbye, out the window, you know? Yeah. Yeah.